Boker Tov, everybody. Erev Tov, welcome. It's nice to have Shuli back after we missed her last week. This morning, we'll be taking a tour of the Galil. So we look forward, and please God, soon, although they pushed off entrance to Israel for another month, but please God, soon, hopefully, we can all take tours of Yerushalayim, the Galil, the South, all over, and maybe have Shuli take us on a real live tour and not just on a Zoom tour. Bakasha, Shuli.
Oh, that would be so nice. Okay. Hi, everybody. So today we are going to go to the Kinneret. So let's set that up. And the Kinneret is a beautiful area, so much to talk about. And the satellite picture, I think, also shows it really in such an interesting way. The depth, the topography, when the Gemara talks about the moving of the Sanhedrin from place to place. So the Sanhedrin's final destination after going from Jerusalem out many other places goes to Tveria, Tiberias. We're going to talk about that. Tveria is the home of tradition of the Mesorah. And what the Gemara Rosh Hashanah says is Tveria hi amuka mikulam. Tveria is the deepest of all. Now, obviously, there's a philosophical idea going on there, right? It's the Mesorah stays there for a long time. It has deep roots there, but it's also a very simple physical fact that Tveria is low down. We are low, 200 meters below sea level. If you've ever been to Tveria in the summer, you know it is a rather warm place. Okay, so that's what you can see, I think, nicely in the picture. The Kinneret is a very significant place because it has fresh water, because it's very fertile area agriculturally. There's been life there for thousands of years. We're going to talk about a bunch of things, but in terms of historical periods, we're going to focus on the beginnings of Christianity as well as Rabbinic Judaism, meaning 2,000 years ago, give or take. That's a very important period in this area. And we're also going to talk about the beginning of the 20th century and the revolutionary ideas and the new communities and the new types of lifestyles, right? Kibbutz, moshav, that start from here. So those are the two places we're going to focus, two times we're going to focus on, but we have a lot of things to talk about. The Kinneret has a few different names, right? In English, it's often called the Sea of Galilee. In ancient times, it was called Yam Ginosar, the Sea of Ginosar, which is one of the places on the northwestern side of the Kinneret. Why is it called the Kinneret? That's a great question. Some people suggest that it looks a little bit like a kinnor, like a harp. Does it look like a harp? Okay, maybe a little bit. It's a nice explanation. Dimensions, not a very big lake, right? We call it the Sea of Galilee, but really it's kind of a glorified lake. Those of us who are joining from Canada, this is really a puddle, okay? But for Israel, we don't have a lot of seas, so we get to have this one. And the dimensions north to south, 21 kilometers. The widest point east to west, you can see it varies. The widest point is 13 kilometers. So we are not talking about a very large body of water, but it is a very significant body of water. And like I said, 210 meters below sea level. So where are we going? Right, we have this nice map that will take us all around. Let's understand a little bit where we are going. Sorry, using a different computer, so just have to get used to what I'm doing here. Okay, so we are going to go to various places around. We are obviously going to visit Tveria, right? Tiberias, the city that's around the Kinneret. We are going to go to some of the Jewish communities from Second Temple times, right? Which are also connected to the Christian story. So Kfar Nahum, Migdal. We're not going to go to Kursi, but it's important to know about it, right? So those are different places we're going to go. And then we want to talk about the modern story, right? That 20th century story, that's down here. Kinneret, Degania, Tzemach, right? All those different places. And the last thing we're going to talk about really is the whole, this area over here, right? On the eastern side of the Kinneret, what happens to it between 48 and 67. Okay, so now that we've marked up this map so nicely, we're understanding where we're going to be going. Let's get a sense not just of where we are, but of when we are. Okay. So let's take a look at our timeline for a moment. Yes, the timeline goes back very, very far. Do not fear. We're not going to be spending time talking about millions of years. That's going to take us a little too long. But be aware that there are prehistoric sites around the Kinneret, and that's very important. Early man and woman, right, is always going to be in fertile areas, and the Kinneret is part of that story of fertile areas. We're really going to start more with biblical times, right? Mid Bronze to the Iron Age, and then the Persian period, 2000 BCE to 500 BCE. We've got Canaanite settlements, Israelite settlements, the Arameans on the eastern side, okay, and some of these ancient names, Reket, Kinarot, Beit Saida, we're going to talk about them. One of the most significant periods, as we mentioned before, Second Temple times, right? Give or take, not the very beginning of Second Temple times, not the Persian period, but more from Hasmonean times, 200 BCE. That's really when you get Jewish communities starting to grow around here. Jews and early Christians, who are, of course, also Jews. And definitely the New Testament emphasizes this idea of Jesus's disciples who are around the Kinneret. Some of them are fishermen, right? And that's why you have these stories. And therefore, you also have sites that get built, right? Synagogues originally, and then churches. So that is all part of our story. An important milestone, the year 20 of the Common Era, Tiberias is built as a new city. Herod Antipas, Herod's son, builds it. We're going to see why. Okay. The Muslim period, the 7th to the 11th century, Tveria is a regional capital for the Muslims. It's also a very important Jewish center. Even after the redacting of the Jerusalem Talmud, it remains an important Jewish center. We'll talk about the Masoretes and the Paitanim, the poets and the grammarians who live in Tveria. Periods of lesser importance. In the 16th century, we have this fascinating blip of Dona Gracia Nasi attempting to rebuild Tveria as the capital of an autonomous Jewish state. It doesn't happen, but it's a great story. Okay? In the 18th century, Dar el-Omar rebuilds Tveria. What's with all the rebuilding? Okay, Tveria is in a place where it's on a fault line. There are earthquakes here. So things are destroyed and things are rebuilt. And that's why, despite the very, very long and glorious history of Tveria, there isn't that much archaeology to see because a lot of it has been destroyed today. That's, thank God, being somewhat rectified. They are doing more excavations and opening them up more. Tveria, modern Tveria, has some dysfunctions and some issues, but they are starting to do that a little bit. Jumping forward to the early 20th century, we have the story of the Second Aliyah and all of these revolutionaries, who they are, what do they do? One of them, of course, is Rachel Blaustein, Rachel the poetess, so I put her in here. And 1956, the National Water Carrier Project, and we're going to talk about water, so that's important to understand as well. Okay, so that's just to give us a little bit of a sense of a timeline. Water is so important. Just the title, if you're unfamiliar with this, this is a song by Naomi Shemer, Lashir Zekmoliot Yarden, to sing is to be like the Jordan. It's a beautiful song. The lyrics are beautiful as well. Look it up if you're not familiar with it. But basically, she talks about how a person's life is very much like the Jordan, in the sense that it begins with great passion and excitement and rushing springs all the way up in the north. And then as time goes on and it flows down, you have, you know, the Sea of Galilee, and you're settled and you're stable. And ultimately, right, everybody ends up in Yam HaMavet. Everybody ends up in the Dead Sea, right? But you've created this beautiful song as you go along. So it's just a nice nice title, but important for us to understand, where is the water coming from? Okay, so water in the Kinneret, water in this whole area, very, very important. It's all ultimately coming from the source waters of the Jordan, right? All the way up here, right? The Sneer, the Banyas, and the Dan, they are joining together, creating the Jordan River, which flows into the Kinneret. Ultimately, it comes out of the Kinneret, we're going to see that in a minute, and continues to flow until its terminus in the Dead Sea. Right? All kinds of nice things you could say about that, but that's what's important for us to understand, just in terms of nature, geography. What that means is the water is mostly sweet. It's not completely sweet. There is some little bit of salt water because it's coming from some springs, not only from rain, right, and underground. A lot of this water is sent into the National Water Carrier. We're going to see a picture of that in a minute. And the Kinneret is basically – If you don't want to think of it as a sea or even as a lake, think of it as the largest water reservoir in Israel. And that's why we are always very obsessed with how much water is in the Kinneret, because this is where we keep our extra water, right? Seems a little bit crazy, but we don't have so much extra water. So this is part of the story, is that the Kinneret is a large water reservoir. Hey, the Degania Dam, the Secher Degania, let's just go back for 1 second, right? That is all the way down here at the southern edge, at the point where the Kinneret and the Jordan re-meet again, right? Not at the northern edge, but the southern edge. And Secher Degania, this dam, is meant to regulate the water levels in the Kinneret, and so that it flows into the Jordan. Now, originally, the dam was built as part of this very ambitious project by an incredible guy called Pinchas Rutenberg, one of these real Renaissance men. He was involved in both Russian revolutions. He was on the run. He was a wanted man, but he also was a brilliant engineer. And he eventually comes to the land of Israel, and he begins the first electrical power plants in the land of Israel. And he does that by harnessing the water power of the Jordan River and of the Yarmouk River. And that's why he builds this dam, right? Because you want to be able to regulate the water levels. Today, the Rutenberg power plant in Naharaim, it does not exist as a power plant anymore. We have other ways to make electricity, but the dam is still here. And the idea is to make sure that all the water in the Kinneret doesn't flow into the Jordan River and into the Dead Sea in sparse years. It's meant to regulate what's going on. It's rarely opened, right? And since 2013, it's been opened a little bit so that there's a small constant flow of water into the southern part of the Jordan, because the Jordan River, if you know a little bit about environmental issues in Israel, the southern part of the Jordan River is in terrible shape, and it's drying up and it's polluted, and we want to put in a little more water. But in general, not all the water flows from the Kinneret out into the Jordan, and the dam is only completely opened up when we've had an incredibly rainy year and there's a risk of flooding, which happens very frequently. I think the last time it happened was in the early 90s when there was a lot of water. A couple of years ago, they were considering opening it because we did have a rainy winter, but it wasn't quite enough, right? But in Israel, when you say they're opening the Degania Dam, that's like, wow, there was an unbelievable rainy winter, right? But in general, the progress of the Kinneret, the height of the Kinneret, is a very big deal. I always think of it as, you know, Israelis watch the height of the Kinneret like we watch our children's progress in school. We're so proud of you, Kinneret. You did great this winter. You have so much water there. That's amazing, right? And in fact, a few years ago, they actually put up this Kinneret meter on the coast in Tveria, where you can watch and you can track the height and how much water there is. Okay, it's a very important thing, not only because we use this as a water reservoir, but because if the water gets too low, and anyone who lives in Israel knows there's the red line, there's the black line, we're always watching this. If the water level gets too low, it will contaminate the groundwater, right? It also means there won't be fish. It also means there won't be beaches, right? All of these things are part of the story. And there is a certain obsession, even though today we have, thank God, so many other water solutions, whether it's desalinization or it's treating wastewater. But still, this is a big deal, the Kinneret, and how much water is in the Kinneret. It's a national sport to a certain extent. Now, part of the story of the Kinneret as a water reservoir is this incredible infrastructure project, which is called the National Water Carrier, the Movil Ha'artzi. There was a suggestion of doing something like this already in the 40s, but we didn't have the ability to do it. But in the 50s and 60s, the Mikorot company is founded, and there's this incredible project to bring the water. You can see it in this map here on the left, right? To bring the water from Tiberias in pipelines to both to the center of the country as well as to the Negev. This is a project that's spearheaded by Levi Eshkol. Before he becomes prime minister, he's the head of Mikorot, and it's a huge national infrastructure project taken on in the 50s when we're not so, you know, good at these things. We don't have so much of an economy. This was a massive project, and it was successful, and it's still used today, even though, like I said, we have other water sources. The water has to be raised up, so there's a pumping station at the northeast, north western part of the sea, right? The Tachanat Sapir, which you can see up here. There's a large reservoir along the way, right? You could see it at what's called Somit HaMovil, the National Water Carrier Intersection, right? And the reservoir is named the Eshkol Reservoir. It's named after Levi Eshkol. So this is a project that was very significant in the early years of the state, but it's still being used today with, like I said, lots of different things to supplement it. One of the other things about water, not the use of water, but more the significance of water, at that point where the Kinneret flows back into the Jordan, right, down in the south, you have a beautiful site that's called Yardenit. Now, Yardenit is a fascinating site. It was made in 1981. It's a beautiful place to come. You can either come here or you can go to the part that's like free and open near the parking lot. It's a beautiful place to swim because you have the Jordan River waters, you have which are, you know, a little bit rushing. You have the Kinneret waters, which are mostly still. And it's really very beautiful. But why was this site created? Because the New Testament talks about a very important event where John the Baptist encounters Jesus, right, by the banks of the Jordan. And Jesus says, "Baptize me." And John says, no, you are the master. You should baptize me, right? Back and forth. And finally, John agrees to baptize Jesus in the Jordan. And after he baptizes him, Jesus has what's called an epiphany, right? He has a vision of God. He sees God as a dove. This is a very significant event in Christianity. And in fact, there's a holiday called Epiphany in January where you commemorate this event. Now, really, the story most likely happens in what's called Kasar al-Yehud, okay, the area of the Jordan that's all the way at the south, almost before it flows into the Dead Sea, opposite Jericho, the place that we think the children of Israel cross into the land of Israel. And that's where today, certainly on January 19th, on Epiphany Day, there will be thousands and thousands and thousands of Christians who will come and be baptized in the site. However, up until about 15 years ago, okay, the site in the south, Kasar al-Yehud, was inaccessible to regular visitors. It was a closed military zone. You could not go in there because Israel and Jordan were at peace, but it was still a cold peace. And certainly in the early years in the 70s, there were terrorists who infiltrated through there from Jordan, and it was not a place that the army was willing to open up. Okay? So in 1981, because of the demands of Christian tourists, we want to go to a place, we want to baptize where Jesus baptized. Okay, so it's not exactly the same place. It's the same Jordan, it's the same river, all the water flows together, right? Let's create this site, which is a really much nicer site. The water is much cleaner than down in the south. And even though today Kasar al-Yehud has been opened up, right, and it is accessible to visitors and you could come in, and Christian tourists come there all the time and Jews come there as well, even so, people still come to Yardenit because it's nicer, right? Whether or not the story really took place there, it's definitely a more pleasant place to come to. The local kibbutz Kfutzat Kinneret owns and manages the site. And I always think of it as a nice Israeli/Jewish way to make a living, right? You have all these Christian tourists who come and it's very respectful, and you have prayers on the wall, as you can see in the top picture there, not prayers, the story from the New Testament of the baptism. But of course, you have to exit through the gift shop. And what's being sold in the gift shop, such a you know, Jewish way of thinking, you could go and, you know, take your empty soda bottle and scoop up some water from the Jordan. But a lot of tourists will walk into the souvenir shop and pay $3 for a little bottle of holy Jordan water. So it's a classic Israeli entrepreneurship. And they do very well when Christian tourists are here. All right, so that's the story of the Yardeni. But let's go back to our historical story a little bit, right? Tanakh times, biblical times. There is settlement here, okay? Like I said, there's always settlement here because there's water, there's agriculture. We're on the edge of the tribe of Naphtali, as you can see here, Naphtali, Issachar, right? And also the other side of the Jordan, the Ever HaYarden. There are no super important cities here. We hear about cities in the book of Joshua and other places, Reket, Kinarot, Beit Saida, but not a ton. Okay. The other side, the eastern side of the Kinneret, is not a Jewish area, right? The western side is Jewish tribes, but the eastern side is not. And we have nations called Aram and Geshur, who we sometimes have friendly relationships with, right? King David has a relative, is a relative of the king of Geshur, right? But we sometimes have not so friendly relationships with them, like the Arameans who were at war with for over a century. So it's a complicated place. One of the draws of this area that continues even more so in Second Temple times are hot springs, right? And that's the picture you see here on the right. These are the hot springs in Chamat Tveria. That's where the name comes from. Chamat, Cham, hot. And they're still a draw today, by the way, but they certainly were a draw in biblical times and in Second Temple times. Now, like we said, Second Temple times is when this area really comes into its own. It becomes very significant for Jews and for Christians. And that's why I always like to point out, not just the Kinneret, but the Galil in general, there are two trails that have been created relatively recently. Okay? The first one was the picture that you see here on the right called the Gospel Trail, Derech HaBsorah, which an enterprising person in the tourism ministry said a lot of Christians come to the Galilee. Some of them are hikers, right? A lot of them are going around on tour buses, but some of them are hikers. Let's create a hiking trail for them that goes to various sites that are significant in the history of Christianity. And you can see it on the rock here, right? From Nazareth to Kfar Kana, right? Up to the Arbel and to the churches around the Kinneret. This is the Gospel Trail. Along came some Jews and said, well, you know, that's very nice, but there were also, there's another story here in the Galil from the same time period, and that's the story of the Sanhedrin, right? The rabbis that move up north after the Bar Kokhba revolt, and this is a very significant area. If we have a Gospel Trail, shouldn't we also have a Sanhedrin trail? And so that was created as well. And it's basically finished, right? And you can travel from Usha to Shfar'am to Beit Sha'arim, right? To all the sites where the Sanhedrin were. Some of the sites are more developed. Some are being developed now. But I think these two things side by side are great because they really give us a sense of the importance of the Galilee in Second Temple times, Roman times, Byzantine times. We hear a lot about the Galilee in the Gemara. Okay, a lot of the rabbis are living there. We have, it's not always so clear. Some scholars are very into this, some are less, but it seems that the Galilee and Jerusalem are not the same place, right? There used to be a feeling in academia that the Galilee was considered to be a place that was much less knowledgeable, that the Jews cared less about halakha, that they asked fewer questions. Today, the opinions are more divided, but it does seem from statements in the Gemara that the Galilee was a more modest place, right? We seem to find that men and women who were engaged and not married, at least according to the Gemara, in Yehuda and Judah, they would move in together. In the Galilee, not so much, right? They were less knowledgeable about the temple, but they felt very connected to the temple. And one of the things that's interesting that we have, the Gemara talks about it, and we see in archaeology as well, is language, right? The Gemara talks about how Bnei Yehuda, the people of Judea, the south, they kept their language, meaning they spoke Hebrew or Aramaic. And the Bnei Galil, the people of the Galilee, they weren't as careful about their language. And that's borne out in synagogue inscriptions, which in Yehuda are largely in Hebrew or in Aramaic, whereas in the Galilee, a lot are in Greek. So that's a fascinating distinction that the Gemara talks about, but that we really do see today. Are they more simple people as opposed to scholars? Not so clear. But again, we have lots of different ideas in the Gemara, some of it borne out by archaeology, some of it yet to be seen. One of the fascinating discoveries was found about 40 years ago is what's called the Jesus boat. It has really a very tenuous connection to Jesus. It's a fishing boat from the first century of the Common Era. And since we know that some of Jesus' disciples were fishermen, right? The New Testament talks about that. And since this is the same time period, it got the name the Jesus boat. It's displayed in the museum in Ginosar. It's a fascinating thing. If you look at it, you can see in the picture, it's made out of wood. and it's 2,000 years old, right? Which is pretty wild. What we think, what we know about these boats, these fishing boats, is that they're used for decades, and you just keep on patching it up and patching it up and patching it up until finally there's more holes than boat. And at that point, why bother? You just let it sink to the bottom of the Kinneret. Now, this one is one of those boats that was sunk to the bottom of the Kinneret. Because it was covered by mud, it was preserved, right? And it's an amazing thing. It was discovered in 1986 at a period when the Kinneret was kind of at a low point, and it was found. Now, we know, not just from literary sources, but just from what we can see about the place, Kinneret was definitely a place that was used for fishing. It was used for boats. Every town had a port, okay? You transport things by boat. It's much easier than transporting it on the roads, okay? And you definitely have fishermen as well, right? We hear about a place called Migdal Nunya. We're going to talk about Migdal, right? Nun in Aramaic is a fish. And definitely, this is a place where there are a lot of fishermen. It's not only, the source is not only from the New Testament, but from Jewish sources as well. And here we are in Migdal. So Migdal is one of the most fascinating newer discoveries. There are a lot of them around the Kinneret. Migdal is slightly north of Tiberias. Right? Once you drive out of Tiberias, you're in Migdal in about 10 minutes. Now, this is a city, Migdal, Magdala, it's the same thing. Right. In the New Testament, we hear about a lady called Mary Magdalene from Mary of Magdala. So Migdal was clearly a place that was an important town in the time of Jesus. Now, already in the 1970s, there were excavations that were done here in part of the town. They were done by the Franciscans, right? The Catholic priests who were very into archaeology. They knew there's a Christian connection here. They excavated in the southern part of the town, and they found a wealthy, planned city, okay? Most of it can't be visited today, unfortunately. It's off limits. The Franciscans have control of it, but it had a port, and it had a bathhouse, and it had a fountain, and it was a very important place, okay? But nothing seriously Jewish that was discovered there. And then what happened? 2009, there was a wealthy Mexican priest named Father Solana, and he decided that this was a great place, it was an important place to build a Christian retreat center and a church because of the significance of the place to Christianity. So he managed to buy the land and get the permits. But before you can do anything in Israel, as we know, you always have to excavate. So he brought in an archaeologist from the Israel Antiquities Authority, whose name is Najjar Arfan. He's a Muslim Arab from the Galilee. And he started to dig. And a few weeks into the dig, he calls up Father Solana and he says, "Listen, I have bad news and I have good news," right? That's often part of archaeological stories. He says, "The bad news is you're not building your retreat center anytime soon. The good news is we found the synagogue that's from the time of Jesus," right? Now, that's really big news, not just for Christians, but for Jews too, because this is a very early synagogue. It's one of the earliest synagogues. It's from the beginning of the first century of the Common Era. If you know a little bit about early synagogues, you might be familiar with Herodium, with Masada. Those are from the time of the Great Revolt. This is around the time of Gamla, also one of the early synagogues. And it's pretty rare to find such a thing. Okay? It's not very big, but it's beautifully decorated. And you guys are seeing it here, right? The picture on the left is showing the whole structure. The picture on the right, you can see it a little bit better. Benches around the side, mosaics, pillars, all the things that are part of the architecture of a synagogue, with this thing in the middle that we're going to talk about in a minute, because it's very strange and very interesting, right? And they continued to excavate, obviously. They eventually did build the church. The church is there, but not in the site of the archaeology. It's a little bit further down. But they continued to excavate, and they found amazing things. First of all, they found the market, which is right near the synagogue. This is presumably the northern suburb of this wealthy town of Migdal, right? And there isn't another neighborhood. Now, right by the synagogue, they found a market. And we know Migdal had a few names. I told you, the Gemara talks about it as Migdal Nunya, Migdal of the fish. Josephus talks about it as Tarikeia. Tarikeia in Greek means salted fish. Clearly, this is a town whose product is fish. They want to be selling fish. That's what they're making their money from. Now, in the marketplace, they actually found in the stores, these deep basins, which you think is where they kept the fish or salted the fish, right? Fascinating thing. They also found houses, very fancy houses, with all kinds of mosaics. They found an incense shovel, a machta, which is very interesting because there's no temple here. What would they use it for? We don't really know. And one of the things they found here, which is fascinating because it's unprecedented, here you are, you're literally 100 meters from the Kinneret. The houses, like many Second Temple period houses, had mikvaot built into the houses, ritual baths built into the houses. That's not unusual. What's unusual is two things. Number one, that you would build such a thing when you could just walk 5 minutes to the Kinneret and immerse yourself there, number one. Why'd they build this? More private, more elegant, more convenient, who knows? Number two, these mikvaot, unlike every other mikvah we have found in the land of Israel, which is filled by rainwater, these are filled from the Kinneret, okay, from the groundwater that fills the Kinneret. The same groundwater fills these mikvahs. And when Nadjar Arfan was excavating, they saw that once they cleared it and they opened it up, the mikvaot would fill up with water by themselves. They had to actually put in a drainage system. And it's a fascinating thing. Now, the other thing they found was that this Beit Knesset at some point was dismantled. Only part of it was left. And a wall was built nearby. Was the wall built because they're waiting? They're going to be, they know the revolt with the Romans is coming. Josephus tells us that Migdal takes apart a very strong part in the battles against the Romans. Did they take apart the synagogue and use those stones for the wall because of the fear of the Romans? Perhaps, right? But I want to show you the strangest thing that was found here. Strange in the sense that we have no precedence for it. These are both copies. The real one is hidden away somewhere in an antiquities warehouse. They haven't displayed it yet in the Israel Museum, but it's an amazing thing. Okay, this is a stone. Okay, I don't know if you can get a sense of the dimensions here, but it's a nice size stone. I would say probably like a half a meter by a half a meter, or a half a meter by a little bit less because it's a rectangle. It's very short. Okay, it's also, you know, not more than a meter tall, even less than that. Okay, so it's not a table because it's too short. It's not a chair because chairs in those days had arms. It doesn't have arms. We don't have anything that looks like this. Now, not only that, but if you look at it, you can see it is richly, richly decorated. And the decorations are all themes that connect to the temple, right? So take a look and you can see what you have. I mean, the most obvious is nice menorah, right? You have a menorah in the middle. Okay, you have these jugs, which maybe were jugs that were used for oil. You have pillars, right? Columns, a facade that you would, a facade of the temple. Okay, that's what these are probably, these things over here on both sides. Okay, on the other parts, you have rosettes, you have these kind of palm trees, sort of, which are maybe also part of this facade of the temple. All of the designs seem to be very connected to the temple. So what's the deal? What is this stone? What was it used for? Why is it here? We don't have such great answers because when you don't find something else like it, it's hard to know, right? So there are suggestions. We have texts that in the Gemara that talk about a special chair called Catedra de Moshe, right? Moses's armchair, which is where Gvirim, right? The important people of the community would sit. Maybe that's what this is, but again, it doesn't really look like a chair. Maybe it's used as a base for putting out your Torah when you read from the Torah, but it's very low. Why would you have it so low, right? A lot of unanswered questions, but the one thing you do see from here is these temple motifs, which seem to indicate that Migdal, far away at Kinneret, right? A good couple of days walk to Jerusalem. They are very connected to the temple and to Jerusalem. They're living far away, but they want to have some representation of the temple in their synagogue. This is a little bit similar to Gamla, right? We're going to go to the Golan in a few weeks. Gamla, when they're fighting, right? They mint coins when they fight the Romans. That talks about Geulat Yerushalayim HaKadoshah, redemption of Holy Jerusalem. The people of the Galilee, as far as they are away from Jerusalem, feel very much a part of the temple, feel very much a part of Jerusalem. So it's a fascinating thing. The story has not been ended. There's more to find out. But I love Migdal because they found all these new things. And I also love it because it's an amazing story, right? Catholic priests and a lot of Christian volunteers who work there. Muslim archaeologist who knows more about Mikvaot than most Jews, and a Jewish town and synagogue. So what could be better, right? It's a great combination. Very, very worth visiting. And still more going on there. Okay, if you go a little bit further north from Migdal, if you go to kind of the top of the Kinneret, you will get to another very interesting site, which is called Kfar Nachum in Hebrew, or Capernaum, which is the kind of the Greek way to say it, and that's what Christians say. It's a very important Christian site, right? It's a town that's very long lived. It begins in the second century before the Common Era and the Hasmonean period, and it's existing till the earthquake, the great earthquake of 749, which changes so many things in the land of Israel. It's a town that exists consecutively, so for almost 1,000 years. We hear about it in the New Testament. Jesus comes here, he preaches in the synagogue, he cures the sick, and there's a very, very early church here called the House of Peter. House of Peter, which is supposed to be the house where Jesus stays in, becomes a church in the 4th century, Byzantine period. Very beautiful, elaborate church. But there's also a big, beautiful synagogue. And that's what you're looking at in these pictures, right? A synagogue with a monumental facade, right? This is not the small little Migdal synagogue. This is a serious synagogue. It's a very big, impressive synagogue. Now, the question of how you date synagogues is a very interesting one that's changed as archaeology has found more synagogues. Originally, this style with the big pillars, with the fancy facade, everybody said, oh, this is Roman, early Roman, 2nd century, 3rd century, that's what it is for sure, right? And that makes sense because that's when this was still a thriving Jewish town before it becomes an important Christian town. But what happened? They continue to excavate, and underneath the floor, they found a hoard of 25,000 coins. Now, coins are really neat for a few reasons. First of all, it tells you this is a very wealthy town. They can put 25,000 coins underneath the floor, right? The treasure of the town or for good luck or whatever. But coins are very important because they have dates on them. And these coins are from the 4th century of the Common Era. Now, if buried underneath the floor are coins from the 4th century, the floor and the synagogue were not built in the 2nd century. That doesn't make sense. It has to be later, meaning this synagogue is from the 5th century, the 6th century, right? Post-dating the coins. 5th century, 6th century, that's the Byzantine period. Christians are very powerful already. The church is already standing. You're telling me there was a big, beautiful, important synagogue literally next door to a big, beautiful, important church, okay? Jews and Christians definitely live next door to each other, okay? Certainly in the early days, but that doesn't mean that each one allowed the other freedom of religion, right? In the early days, Jews don't want Christians, and we know there are a lot of edicts against early Christianity by the rabbis, and later the Christians don't want Jews. So what's going on here? Could they really have coexisted side by side? So there are a few interesting suggestions. I will tell you the strangest one, which I like. I'm not sure if it's true, but I like. It's a scholar named Tzvika Ma'oz, and he says this was never a real synagogue. The Christian community of the 5th century with their church decided to build a model of a synagogue to show where Jesus preached. Does that make sense? I'm not sure, but I like it, right? It's interesting. We definitely know that in the early days of Christianity, when the early Christians are Jews, right, but Jews believe in Jesus, the Jews see them as a threat and as encroaching, which flips later, right? The Christians don't want the Jews nearby. And in the beginning, the Jews don't want the Christians nearby. And that's why we have all these edicts like Birkat Haminim in the Amida prayer, where we talk about, you know, the people who are not wanted in the shul, the heretics who we don't want in the synagogue. We also have interesting things about, you know, if you have books that have the name of God, but they are books of the Minim, of the heretics, and they're burning on Shabbos. Not only do you not rescue them on Shabbos because of God's name, but you want them to burn. You should burn them, right? All kinds of things like that, to the extent that we even have a statement by Rabbi Ishmael, not just a statement, an incident where his nephew dies because he doesn't allow him to go to a Jewish Christian healer, because that would be worse. This way he dies in this world, but in the next world. So we have a lot of very harsh again, Christians, and that's why this is a fascinating story of what it is. Okay, one more last thing from early days, and that's the synagogues that are being discovered now kind of opposite Migdal. We have two different synagogues that have been excavated for the last 10, 15 years, one called Wadi Hammam, and one is called Chukok. These are fascinating for a few reasons. First of all, Wadi Hammam is a very early synagogue. It's destroyed already in the 4th century. We don't have a lot of synagogues between Second Temple times and 4th, 5th, 6th century. We won't have a ton, right? We have Beit Alpha and Chama Tveria, many, many synagogues. But that in-between period, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, we don't have so much. And Wadi Hammam is an early synagogue. So that might help us to understand the chronology of synagogues. That's really interesting. Number two, it has mosaics. A lot of synagogues have mosaics. Beit Alpha and Chama Tveria and Sipori. But their mosaics are just bizarre, right? They're things that we've never seen before. Art scenes, biblical scenes that are very unusual. For example, take a look at the one on the left. You have this very large guy, only his legs have survived and his nice skirt, who's grabbing three much smaller guys by the hair. Is this David and Goliath? Unlikely, because it's a few fighters against one. More likely, this is Samson, right? Samson, who's considered to be a giant, fighting the Philistines. We have another Samson mosaic in Chukok. What's going on? We don't have any Samson mosaics anywhere in the land of Israel. Suddenly we're finding two. Okay, the picture on the right seems to be a picture, a depiction of okay, take a look at these. These are from Chukok. This is being dug by Jody Magnus from North Carolina University. And she's also finding crazy mosaics. Take a look at the one on the right. This is Samson carrying the gates of Aza, right? When he has to sleep in the city and is trapped, and he picks up the gate and carries them on his shoulders. That's the picture that you're seeing there, right? Besides this really beautiful human representations here, the picture on the left is if you can see the sailors in the boat, and then you can see the fish that's swallowing up this guy. That's, of course, Jonah. Only the artist decided it wasn't one fish. It was a series of fish, right, that are just swallowing, each one swallowing up the next, swallowing up the next. All kinds of amazing things. People who learned Daf Yomi may remember that last Shabbos, we learned about the story of Alexander the Great and his encounter with Shimon HaTzadik. It's a great story where they meet. There is perhaps a representation of that story in a mosaic in Chukok. It's disputed if that's what's going on, but it seems to be a white-bearded guy wearing white, seems to be the Kohen Gadol, meeting a Greek guy with elephants. Is this the story? Maybe. But we're finding, and it's just a great example of how Jewish art and Jewish synagogue art will always surprise us. Okay, let's move on to Tveria, to Tiberias. Okay, this is a city that is founded by Herod Antipas, Herod's son. Okay? Amazingly, there is no real serious city on the Kinneret, despite the fact that it's so important for the economy and all sorts of other things, but everybody has a little port. There's no one big city. Okay? But Herod Antipas, guided by his father's economic sense, right? Herod was a great businessman. Herod Antipas says, let's build a serious city, a serious port on the Kinneret, and it'll be a moneymaker. And that's what he does. Now, there is a city that is earlier, that's a little bit south of the new city that's built in the early first century. It's called Hamat. Hot from the hot springs that are there. Tiberias is the continuation of Hamat. Ultimately, they become one city. But here's the problem. Because Tiberias is to the north of Hamat, meaning it's outside the city limits of Hamat, what's outside the city limits? Cemeteries. Okay? And people don't want to move into Tiberias because I don't want to live on top of graves. Impurity, right? Impurity is a big deal in this time period. We have this great story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who after his 13 years in the cave hiding from the Romans, he comes out and decides that he needs to do something for the Jewish people. And he figures out where the graves are in Tiberias, and he basically koshers the city, right? He plants these lupin seeds where they grow. That's where the graves are. Don't live there. Live in the other places, right? Great story. Today, we are starting to excavate more and understand more about the city. The modern city of Tiberias, north, I mean, it really stretches all the way, but the city grew, and in Crusader times, it was further north. But here you have a great picture On the left here of what we think the city looked like, right? The city gate, the towers, we'll see them in real life in a minute. The main, the Cardo, right? This main north-south street. Along the way, they discovered a theater. They discovered a bathhouse. Theater could see Tiberias was definitely a very Jewish city, but that doesn't mean it didn't have Roman values and Roman architecture. And this is what's
You're frozen.
Byzantine walls, right? We hear about the gate, the Shar Ha'ir of Tiberias. We hear about it in our sources. Rabbis hanging out there. They're seeing the dead being brought for burial there. They're learning Torah there. It's mentioned a lot. So to be able to be there is really a very cool thing. And underneath, right, it's a very sophisticated city. They dig this very impressive drainage channel because there's water that's flowing down from the mountains above and you want it to flow into the Kinneret and not flood the streets. This was originally exposed in the 30s, then it was covered up again, and then it was re-exposed in the 90s. The picture on the right here is a bathhouse, which of course any good Roman city that's worth its salt is going to have. So you have all of these various installations that are being uncovered today in the city, and we're really getting a sense of ancient Tveria, and these are excavations that are ongoing. But Tveria continues to exist. So it's an important city already in Second Temple times, becomes more important in Byzantine times. But even after the Jerusalem Talmud is completed, and even after Jewish life, the land of Israel is not the center of Jewish life anymore. The center really moves to Babylonia. Tiberias remains an important place. Okay? It's considered to be, like we said, the deepest of all, the home of the Masorah. This is where the Sanhedrin sat. This is where the Jerusalem Talmud is edited and redacted. Now, because it's the home of the Masorah, you have to have some very important people buried here. So for example, Rabbi Akiva's grave, right? So you see here on top, is assumed to be in Tveria, even though chances are in real life that it probably is not. But where should Rabbi Akiva be if not Tveria? Because Tveria is the home of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Who's the Torah Shebaal Peh if not Rabbi Akiva, right? As time passes, you don't have a Sanhedrin anymore. You don't have Tanaim and Amoraim anymore, but you still have two very important Jewish things that are happening in Tiberias. Number one is the Paitanim, the poets, the religious poets. We have so many important kinot and piyutim, some of which have stayed in our liturgy, some of which we don't say so much anymore, but a lot of them come from Tiberias. It's a literary center, okay? And literary Hebrew and Hebrew development is very important. And on top of that, right, to talk about Hebrew, you have these guys called the Masoretes, the guys who come up with the Masorah, not Masorah as in giving the halacha from generation to generation, but how do we read the text? And they are the guys who say, well, it's been fine and good up until now, passing it down generation to generation. This is the punctuation. This is the vowels. But now people might forget, and we need to create a system. And it's only with the Masoretes, right? Only with the 7th, 8th, 9th century that they come up with the vowelization system and with the ta'amim, right? With the tune that is written out in actual symbols in, not in the Sefer Torah, but in tikkuns, in chumashim, right? Invaluable, because how else would we know what to read? So these guys are the ones who really make sure that the tradition is carried on, and the most, what we consider to be the most correct text of the Bible, the Keter Aram Tzova, the Aleppo Codex, is written in Tiberias, okay? Written in Tiberias and then goes through many different journeys, but that's a different story. So take a look at this picture on the bottom here. A few years ago, the city of Tiberias decided they wanted to put in all kinds of great art along the water, right? And this is one of the sculptures they commissioned, and I love it because you see these little people, right? You see these little guys, and they're all carrying their burdens. What are they carrying? They're carrying vowels, right? They're carrying the ooh and the ah and the oh, and you can see them, and you can also see it on the floor, on the pavement. They have, it looks almost like Braille, but they have the vowels that are written out. So this is a very important thing that originates in Tiberias. Okay, two last Tiberias stories. The story of Dona Gracia. Okay, Dona Gracia, Jew, from, the family's originally from Spain. When the Jews are kicked out of Spain, they move to Portugal, where they are forced to convert as well a few years later. Dona Gracia is born into this converso family, right? These hidden Jews. She only finds out as a teenager that she's not a Catholic girl, but a Jewish girl. She's married off very young because that's what the conversos did. They would marry each other. And to make a very long story short, she's a very clever woman. Her husband dies early on in their marriage. He is very, very wealthy, right? Diego Mendez. And he hands over to her before he dies the business so that she becomes the single wealthiest woman in Europe. The wealthiest, but she has the most ships of any person in Europe. And she uses these ships. She has to move from place to place because of the Inquisition, because they're always trying to take her money. So she moves first to Antwerp, and then she moves on to Italy. Ultimately, she ends up in Turkey, where she can live freely as a Jew again. And if you don't know her story, look her up. She's fascinating. But two things. First of all, she uses her ships and her trade network as a kind of underground railroad to get many, many Jews out to safety from under the Inquisition and bring them to safety in countries where they can live freely as Jews. And as she becomes an old woman, she understands that this is all very nice, but the Jews need something that's a more permanent solution. And she comes up with, in the 1550s, right, 400 years before the state of Israel, the idea that there has to be an autonomous Jewish state. And she goes to the Ottoman Sultan and she says, listen, I want to buy from you the town of Tiberias and I want to create an autonomous Jewish state. And he's fine, buy, give me money, great. But she dies before it really happens. But this is it's just an amazing story. And if you go to Tiberias today, there's a hotel named for Dona Gracia, which tells her whole story, and you can dress up in period costume, and it's very cool. In the 18th century, there's a resurgence of the Jewish community, there's a resurgence of the town in general. One of the Jews who comes to live there is someone named Rabbi Chaim Abulafia, or the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, and there's a synagogue there named after him, the Eitz Chaim, and that's what you're seeing in the picture here. And finally, our last thing for Tiberias, because we still have to get to modern times, is important graves, right? Some graves that are unlikely that they're the real people, but they're still significant, like Rabbi Akiva. Other graves that seem to be real, right? Maimonides, the Rambam, is buried in Tiberias. We have a testimony already from the first generation after the Rambam dies that he's buried in Tiberias. So that's a pretty good testimony. And this is, of course, a very significant grave that many people come to visit. And there's all kinds of stuff going on there that the Rambam would be very distressed to see, like buying holy water. Yeah, he wouldn't like it, but it still is a very important place. A little further south is another significant grave. That's the grave of Rabbi Meir Baal Hanes, who we associate with the Tana Rabbi Meir, who lived nearby, right? He lived and he preached in the synagogue in Chamat, so also another very important grave. Let's spend our last few minutes talking about modern stuff. In the early 20th century, 1904 to 1914, we have what's called the Second Aliyah, a young, mostly single, idealistic Jews who, if they had stayed in Europe, would have become part of the communist movement or the Bundist movement, but they are also Zionists. They want to remake the world. They want equality in economics. They want equality in gender. Up to a point, the women are still stuck mostly in the laundry and in the kitchen. Right? And one of the places that they go to is around the Kinneret, where they're going to try all these new things. So, for example, right, you have the Moshava Kinneret, which is what you see a picture of here, right? And it's a training farm to prepare everybody for farmers. And the picture you see here on the right, this is called the women's training farm, Chavat HaAlamot, okay? And the older woman in the middle here, okay, this is someone named Chana Meisel. And she said, you know what? The women pioneers shouldn't have to be stuck in the kitchen and in the laundry. They should also become farmers. And she teaches them how to be farmers, how to work the land. And it's a very idealistic place, right? The value of work and fellowship and creating a new world, right? It's a very, very hard life. There's malaria. There's a lot of disease. But there's this strong belief that they're creating something new. And one of those new things is the kibbutz, right? The kibbutz grows out of this time and place, right? Communal living. Degania is the very first kibbutz. Other new ideas grow out of this here. Also, Jewish self-defense, health funds, right? Kupat Cholim. All of this comes from here, these new revolutionary ideas, which treat everybody equally, except some are less equal than others. So, for example, the poetess Rachel, who has tuberculosis, is kicked out because you're sick and we are well and we don't want you to make us sick, right? And there's very little care for her welfare. So it's a harsh world, but it does create a lot of new ideas that become the background, the backbone of the new state of Israel. Hey, one strange but important little story. If you drive to the Kinneret today, right, especially around the area of Degania, date palms, right, all over, especially this time of year, the dates are getting ripe. Very important crop near there. This is something that's relatively new, even though dates, of course, have grown here for millennia. But dates grow much better from shoots than from seeds. In the land of Israel, date production was very, you know, very big deal in Second Temple times. Then it was neglected throughout the Muslim period. And the dates here were very bad quality. There was very good quality dates in Egypt, in Iraq, but they're not willing to export these shoots. They don't want to give up on their, you know, their economic advantage. So in 1933, there's this gentleman named Ben Sion Yisrael. Israeli, you can see him in the picture, and he goes on a secret mission to Iraq. He has a very little bit of money, and he goes and he smuggles in date palm shoots to plant in Kinneret. Basically, he steals them, right? He brings them back, and they are pretty much the source for the date palms that we have in the land of Israel today. Now, he goes a few times on these missions, and along the way, he also meets local Jews from various communities, so it's actually a fascinating story. Right near the Moshava Kinneret is the very famous Kinneret Cemetery, which has many sad and unknown graves, right? A lot of children who died in these early years, right? People who died very young. It also has some very famous graves. And the two most famous ones are two poetesses, one is born around the time that the other dies. Rachel, the poetess, Rachel Blaustein, very important early Zionist poetess, but as I said, she has TB, she has to leave, they don't want her, she dies, you know, in the center of the country. She dies in 1931. In 1930, in Kfutzat Kinneret, Naomi Shemer is born. Naomi Shemer, who becomes one of the most famous songwriters in Israel, and she writes a lot about being by the Kinneret and looking at the Golan and her childhood in this area. Okay, and our last couple of stories are from Tzemach. Okay, Tzemach is the bottom of the Kinneret, and you can see it in the map here on the right. It's the terminus of what's called the Hejaz Railway. Okay, in Ottoman times, there's a very in Ottoman and British times, very significant rail line that goes in lots of places in the Middle East, and there is a section that's built in the land of Israel, and it goes from Haifa across the Jezreel Valley to Tzemach, and from there continues into Jordan and on to Damascus and other places. It's blown up in 1946 because we don't want to have these bridges, these rail lines that the enemies could come in and attack us. But up until then, it was a very important way to transport products. It was not very fast, right? The joke was that, you know, there's a guy walking along the train tracks and the Jezreel Valley train comes along and the conductor says, "You want to ride?" And he says, no, I'm in a hurry today. I'll walk, right? That's the kind of train it was. Today, it's actually, part of it has been rebuilt and you can take it today, which is kind of neat. And the station has also, the Tzemach station has been rebuilt as a historical site, not used, but as a historical site. So that's nice to see. The other thing at Tzemach, when you're driving to the Kinneret, you drive past the Tzemach Junction at the southern part of the Kinneret, and you pass, you can't miss this large memorial to those who fought and died in wars in the Jordan Valley. Okay, and our final two stories, one rather bizarre. If you go on the eastern side of the Jordan to near Kibbutz Ha'on, eastern side of the Kinneret, excuse me, near Kibbutz Ha'on in the southeastern part of the Kinneret, you will see this monument to Turkish pilots. Turkish pilots seems a little bit strange, right? Very beginnings of flight. 1914, the Ottoman Turks are here. People are just trying out flying. There's a pilot who wants to fly from Istanbul to Alexandria. Okay, and this one, he stops off in Damascus and then he wants to continue and he crashes. Okay? He crashes by the Kinneret, and this is a memorial for him. Okay? He's actually buried in Damascus, but it's a memorial for him. And our final story, in the time period between 48 and 67. okay, between the War of Independence and the Six-Day War, conventional wisdom is that, the Kinneret was basically divided, right? The western side was Israel and the eastern side was Jordan. That's not 100% true, okay? The southeastern side of Ein Gev, up to Susita, Kfar Harul, this area was actually DMZ, zone, but Jews stayed here and there were Jewish communities here under fire from the Syrians. Not an easy place to live, but an important place to hold on to. And it was only after the Six-Day War that this whole other side, the Kinneret, became part of Israel again. So that's just significant to keep in mind. We'll talk more about that when we get to the Golan. And how can we not finish with a beautiful picture of the Kinneret? Let's take a look at questions that people have. Comments, questions, chat. Yes, open up chat. Okay. Where are we on the recording? Yes, there are huge banana plantations around the Kinneret. Yes, I don't know so much about bananas, but I do not think they are indigenous, but they are very successful. You're correct. And you see them wherever you drive around the Kinneret. I agree. I do not know enough to tell you about the bananas. I seem to have started at the bottom of the chat. Let's go to the top. Sorry. What's at the top here? Sorry, like I said, different computer, so less familiar. Okay. Oh, hi, Lisa Leff. Thank you for writing to me. Okay, what else do we have here? John the Baptist, a holiday for Canadians? I do not know. That's a Canadian question. Okay. The foot shape of the Kinneret, right? We have this idea of Gilgal, but this is a natural shape. So, as opposed to the Gilgals, Batya, which are man-made. So maybe they're making it to look like a foot shape. I don't know. Was there a song composed for the opening of the National Water Carrier? I would not be in the least bit surprised, but I don't know of one, but I would love to hear it if you know. John the Baptist was Jewish, right? So John the Baptist and baptism and mikvah, exactly like Zmira wrote, baptism is a variation on mikvah, right? That's the very short answer to a long question, but exactly. Is the Migdal Stone a Zecher LaMikdash? It's not a memory of the temple because it was built while the temple was still standing, right? So it's maybe a memory for people who went there and couldn't go back so soon. There is a book. There are a few books on the ancient synagogues. Most of them are in Hebrew. But if I think of anything in English, I will let you know. Okay. I'm sorry if my voice was not good. You should be able to get the video. The original knee could look different. I'm not sure about everything. Bananas we talked about. And what else do we have here? Date palms. Yes, the date palm story is a fascinating story, but it's not from here, right? These are date palms that were discovered in Masada, in Qumran. They took them down to a kibbutz in Arava, and they actually made some of them be able to grow, and it's a great story. Google the Masada dates, or what's her name? Elaine Soloway is the scientist who did it, and you can find the whole story. The Naomi Shemer song is called Lashir Zekmo Liot Yarden. To sing is to be like the Jordan. Okay? Kibbutz Gin Osar, banana producer and cloning. Okay, thank you. Learning new things about bananas. Where's the Christian baptism site? It's right there. Okay. That, I don't know if it's exactly where you used to swim, but that is what we're talking about, right by Degania and Kinneret. Okay, it's exactly there. Any other questions that I'm missing here? I don't think so. Okay, I hope not. All right. Thank you, everybody. Rabbi Kalman, are you back?
I am. Thank you very much. Okay. Yes. Hello. Okay. Thank you. Except I know there was a couple small sound things, but otherwise it was fine. And hopefully next week you can talk from home. And we thank your daughter for letting her come in where the internet was a little better. Okay. Thank you very much. This evening, Rabbi Yossi Adler from Teaneck, New Jersey, will be giving the Parshat HaShavuot here at 8:30. Everybody's welcome. If you can't sleep in Israel, you're welcome. And here before you go to sleep. And tomorrow morning, I'll be giving the Pirkei Avot Shiur regular shiur at 9:30 in the morning. Sunday, Rabbi Liebtag. Remember, we're going back to our 11 o'clock start time that we did at the beginning. It was 11:15. I'll send that email, but beginning like this Sunday and through the summer, Rabbi Liebtag's class will be at 11 a.m. And then Rabbi Israel's class on Lord Jonathan Sachs will be Monday. And Tuesday, Rachel Sharansky Danziger continued on storytelling. And Wednesday, Simi Peters and Yirmiyahu. I think all those people live in.
Yes. Unmute me. You're unmuted. You're unmuted.
Yeah, you're not muted, but okay, hello. But anyways,
Rabbi,
okay.
Rabbi, is it possible to get a recording of last Monday's lecture on Rabbi Sachs?
Yes. Like I put in the chat box, all you have to do is go to our website, you know, torahinmotion.org, and then find that program, go to the program page and list off all the programs. You click on the program page and on the bottom of the page, you can just click on the recording. You have to log in once. Everybody, they're free, of course, but you have to log in to be able to listen. But once you log in, it sort of automatically, it should automatically recognize.
Oh, great. I hope we get it, you know, because so
it's,
I did send you.
The website. I haven't checked, but yes, it yeah. should be there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Like everything is. Okay, thank you. Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, thank you, everybody. Shabbat shalom. Shabbat someone shalom, asked right. for Hebrew books about synagogues. If you look on the Yad Ben Tzvi website, Yad Ben Tzvi Books, they have a beautiful book about synagogues in the Golan.
When she's finished, wait.
And I believe they also have something about synagogues in the Galil. So look on Yad Ben Tzvi. They have a lot of Hebrew books.
Thank you very much,
everyone.
That was wonderful.
I'm glad.
Okay, Shabbat Shalom. It's Thursday night, of course, in Israel, and although not yet Yom Shishi, right? It's still nice and daylight.
Still light out.
I think you get about an hour. When is the sunset? About 8:30 there? No.
About a quarter to 8.
7:45, right? 7:45. So here we're at 9:05 now.
Yes. In another reason to make Aliyah.
No, actually, I wouldn't say that, but okay. I like the long days, okay. But there are many reasons to make Aliyah, but that's not one of them where I'm coming from. Okay.
All right. Thank you, everybody. See
you next
week.
You don't like making Havdalah at 10 o'clock at night?
No, not at all.
Okay. So.
Yes, Gaya. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Look forward to learning with everybody. Everybody have a wonderful day, wonderful week. Thank you.